The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. A sinking feeling. A mother and daughter are trapped below the deck of a capsized boat. A shrinking air pocket is the only thing keeping them alive. By Derek Burnett. A steady sea breeze livened up the low swells just enough for the late daylight to dance and scatter along their curves. Here, within the inlet, connecting Barnegat Bay to the rougher waters of New Jersey's Atlantic coast, it hadn't been a bad afternoon of fishing, so long as you weren't particularly goal-oriented. Janet Krause and Josefina Gonzalez were doing what they loved most, which was spending time on the water with their little one, four-year-old Riley, who was less active than normal, thanks to the cast she wore after fracturing her leg a month earlier. At every opportunity, the family took to the bay in Krause's father's 23-foot pleasure boat, a well-craft with a small cabin beneath the deck of the bow. They'd swim and fish and swim, sweet afternoons passing with the tides and winds and dawdling mid-year sun. On this evening of August 7, 2022, Krause and Gonzalez were entertaining their friend Ryan Gaudet, along with his 12-year-old daughter Presley and his girlfriend, Marissa Schwer. Riley and Presley, having gotten their fill of the wide world, crawled down into the cabin to fiddle with their iPads while the men fished and the women idled. At about 7 p.m., there came a sudden change around the boat. Where a moment before the water had been placid, it was suddenly rough, and where the breeze had blown stiff and steady, now the wind ranged around as if angling for an attack. That unsettling feeling lasted only a moment before the group heard the crunching sound of the boat's hull striking rock. Unknown to Krause, a jetty at the north end of Barnegat Inlet does not end where it appears to stop abruptly, but rather continues on underwater, often only a foot or so beneath the surface, depending upon the tide. Although marked, this hazard is frequently struck by boaters. He reacted immediately, thrusting the throttle forward to get clear of the rocks. But instead, the boat surged further onto the jetty. Now, with the well-craft's nose raised and its tail wallowing, it took a direct hit over the stern from a wave that half-filled the boat with cold seawater. The shocked adults froze momentarily, preparing to start bailing. But an instant later, a second wave slopped over the stern, depositing an astonishing volume of water. "Off the boat! Everybody get off!" the men yelled. While Krause worked the controls fruitlessly, Gonzalez bolted for the opening to the little cabin. "Girls, get out! Get out!" she yelled. Presley had come to the entryway, and Gonzalez, her glasses and cell phone still in one hand, yanked the girl by the arm onto the deck. "Jump off!" She could see Riley further up in the cabin in her purple life jacket, confused and tentative, unable to move quickly because of her cast. Gonzalez was ducking down into the cabin, reaching for her daughter, when the world shuddered and shifted. In a few short seconds, the water surged into the cabin until the boat stood nearly on its end and then rolled. It had capsized, with mother and daughter on board. The others had all jumped clear of the boat. Without life jackets, they swam and treaded the inlet's waters, which, despite the August heat, were a chilly 60 degrees. Schwer was almost immediately plucked from the sea by another pleasure boat. Krause held on to Presley as they swam back toward the capsized craft, now drifting clear of the jetty, until they could cling to its hull for support. Gaudet began diving underwater to search for Gonzalez and Riley, but without goggles, it was impossible to see. He made his way onto the jetty, where he stood on the submerged rocks, awaiting rescue. Somebody, probably the boaters who had scooped Schwer out of the water, phoned the Coast Guard. They, in turn, reached out to the Beach Patrol lifeguards, the volunteer firefighters, the EMTs, the state police, and even the local sea tow operation, a kind of maritime AAA. Soon, first responders, relaxing in seaside living rooms, kitchens, and at backyard barbecues, got a notification popping up on their active 9/11 app. Barnegat Inlet, capsized boat, 5 in the water, no life jackets. They dropped the remote controls, pool cues, and dinner forks, and rushed to their stations. What Gaudet and Kraus didn't know, as they stared at the boat's hull, was whether Gonzalez and Riley were still alive. They were. Before the capsize had shut out all light, Gonzalez had seen Riley across from her in the cabin, blocked in by floating cushions and other debris, which she'd pulled out of the way to grab her daughter and swing her around piggyback. They stood now in darkness, Riley's arms clutching her shoulders. With the boat upside down, Gonzalez's feet braced against the ceiling of the cabin, while the top of her head touched its floor. There was an air pocket, but not a very big one. The cold water was most of the way up her neck. In terror and shock, Riley whimpered and shivered. "Don't cry, Riley," Gonzalez said. "We're going to get out of here." She could hear thumping on the hull overhead, searchers, obviously, and she reached up and slapped at the floor of the cabin in answer. The pounding continued. They hadn't heard her. Her phone and glasses were still in her hand. She pressed a button, and her wet phone miraculously lit up, so she turned on its flashlight. Beneath the floating bags, ropes, poles, clothes, and life jackets, the water glowed blue in the evening light. Was it even possible to swim down through all that mess, get deep enough to find the door out of the cabin, swim through it, go around the gunwale, the upper edge of the side of the boat, and then make it up to the surface? What choice did she have? The boat was moving, drifting away from the jetty. She could feel that. What if it shifted enough that this last little space filled with water and the boat dragged them down there to what looked like a bottomless sea? "Listen, Mommy's going to try to take us down," she said. "Hold your nose." She plunged down into the water. She pumped her legs and her arms, but did not get far, pushed back up by the buoyancy of Riley's life jacket. That was not going to work. And there was no way she was taking Riley's life jacket off her. "Okay," she said, once they were breathing again in their air pocket. "We're going to call Daddy." Kraus was still clinging to the Wellcraft's hull, thumping his fist against the boat's bottom, when his phone rang. It was his wife, calling from mere feet away, just on the other side of this mass of fiberglass and metal. "Can you breathe?" he asked her. "Are you okay? Is Riley okay?" She assured him that, for now, they were okay. But was anyone going to help her get out? "The Coast Guard is here," Kraus told her. "I'm going to get on their boat now. They'll get you out." Coast Guard Surf Station Barnegat Light deployed a 29-foot vessel with a 4-man crew, which quickly collected Gaudet, Presley, Schwer, and Kraus. Several other vessels were also now on the scene. 2 towboats, a state police launch, and a modified wave runner with a rescue sled attached, carrying volunteer firefighters Andrew Baxter and Hugh Shields. Aboard the Coast Guard ship, Kraus relayed to the crew the unthinkable. His wife was under the capsized boat with their 4-year-old daughter, whose leg was in a cast. And, incredibly, he was on the phone with her. The crew radioed this new information back to land. Coast Guard Commanding Officer Adam Murray had been 40 minutes away when the call came in. And now, hearing the situation as he raced toward the station, his heart sank. In his 23-year career, he'd responded to several calls with people trapped under capsized boats. None had made it out alive. He shuddered as he drove. replaying in his mind the banging coming from beneath the hull as the victims desperately signaled for help, and then the silence. For people in that nightmare circumstance, running out of oxygen and succumbing to hypothermia are both serious risks, but certainly not the only ones. Being trapped beneath an overturned boat is not a static emergency. It's the ticking time bomb, the car dangling over the cliff, the burning building about to collapse. A wave, a bump, a current, or simply the passage of time can cause the air pocket, the only thing keeping the boat on the surface, to fill with water. Of course, one can swim for it, but victims often die after becoming entangled in fishing lines, ropes, poles, and canvas. It's so dangerous beneath a capsized boat that first responders, even the Coast Guard's elite rescue swimmers, are forbidden to dive under a vessel to access the victims. Too many rescuers have died trying it, becoming disoriented, bumping their heads, getting wrapped in debris. So how was Barnegat Light's first responder family going to help these people? Volunteer firefighter Bob Selfridge was the last to make it to the boat ramp. Something of a legend in the community, 58-year-old Selfridge was the oldest lifeguard on the beach. Barefoot Bob, as he was nicknamed for going without shoes all summer long, managed to combine a laid-back surfer dude persona with that of a rock-solid, highly competent rescuer intensely dedicated to emergency services, volunteering with two different fire departments as an EMT. When Selfridge reached the boat ramp, Ocean Rescue Captain Lee Major was in the process of deploying the team's second wave runner. Selfridge, barefoot as usual, hopped aboard its rescue sled, and the pair raced across the bay to the inlet. 6 months before, Selfridge wouldn't have answered the call. On a Sunday evening like this, he'd have been drunk, self-medicating to soothe the accumulated traumas amassed over four decades of rescue work. On February 7, 2022, he had responded to a call regarding an unresponsive infant. The seven-month-old girl had died in his arms. He went home that evening and drank himself nearly to death. The next day, he checked himself into rehab. He hadn't had a drop since, but a family history of alcoholism and his continued exposure to trauma meant he was a walking razor's edge. Under the capsized boat, Gonzalez repeated her assertion to Riley that they were going to get out. Maybe she was only reassuring herself, since the little girl was surprisingly calm, perched there on her mother's back. How much time had passed? 5 minutes? 10? Gonzalez scarcely felt the cold. All she could think about was getting out. Why hadn't anyone come for them yet? Should she try again to swim out? On the Coast Guard ship, Krause put his phone on speaker, and he and a rescuer explained that they were going to try to right the boat using a risky maneuver called parbuckling. If the move worked, the boat would roll upright. But if it failed, it could destroy the air pocket that was keeping Gonzalez and Riley afloat and alive. The rescue crew tied a rope to a cleat on the vessel's submerged gunwale, ran it underwater to the other side of the boat, then up over its hull and back to the towboat some 20 feet away. The towboat motored slowly forward, and the well-craft's bow swung around flat, like the hand of a clock, toward the towboat, the capsized vessel neither rising nor rolling. Beneath, Gonzalez felt the waterline under her chin move and rise slightly, as if the air pocket was shrinking. She lifted her head higher. "It didn't work," Krause told her over the phone, "but the Coast Guard has got some scuba divers coming." "How soon?" "They're almost here." In fact, the helicopter carrying the divers was coming from Virginia Beach, more than an hour away. Anyway, its divers typically did not rescue people. They recovered bodies. She turned off the flashlight to save her battery. Under her feet, the waning daylight swayed in the blue ocean. Gonzalez was sure the air pocket had shrunk further. On the surface, Bob Selfridge was getting antsy. "We have to go down there," he said to Major. Major's mind raced. Rescuers like to have a plan, and then a backup plan, and then a backup plan. How would this work? "I'm just going to go get them," Selfridge said before Major could ask. The team watched in awe silenced as Selfridge pulled on his pair of boogie boarding fins and bummed goggles off of CTO Captain Walter Bond. This could be a one-way trip, Bond thought. Everyone was thinking it, including Bob Selfridge. He took a few deep breaths, lowered himself beneath the gunwale of the boat, swam down and forward, and then looked up. The overturned craft loomed above him in a weird alien green, everything reversed, steering wheel on the left, cabin entry up instead of down, no sign of woman or child. But as he exhaled his bubbles to the dark box that was the portal to the cabin, and entered with his hands held high as if diving upward, he shoved aside debris. He pushed past garbage. He brushed against a human body and then felt air on his hands. He broke the surface and exhaled. He could feel the woman next to him in the perfect darkness. "Hi, I'm Bob, and I'm your lifeguard," he said. On the surface, his colleagues watched mutely while their heartbeats marked the time. No one had discussed a plan, but each was forming an idea of what they'd do once too many seconds had ticked away. Hugh Shields and Lee Major planned to dive in after him. If Selfridge, with goggles, had failed, their own chances would be slim. But he was their friend, a member of the family. "Take my daughter," said Gonzalez. Selfridge didn't see any daughter. Then Gonzalez turned on her phone, and a little girl appeared, whimpering, snuggled against her mother's neck. "What's your name?" Selfridge asked. "Riley." "Do you know how to hold your breath, Riley?" "You too, Riley, from swim lessons," Gonzalez said. "I'll come back for you in just a minute," Selfridge said to Gonzalez. He grasped Raleigh's life jacket, placed his other palm over her crown to protect her from debris, blew into her face to stop her breath, and pulled her with him down into the depths. Gonzalez had no intention of waiting. She dropped down into the water right on Selfridge's heels and dove deep. For Selfridge, exiting the vessel with Riley was easier than entering it alone. Through his goggles, he could see cables dangling in his way, but they were easily avoided. Still grasping Raleigh's life jacket and covering her head with his palm, he used his fins to propel himself quickly clear of the boat and up to the surface. But for Gonzalez, the descent was a rush of blind bewilderment. Almost immediately, she lost sight of Selfridge and Raleigh, and because she could see almost nothing, she had no idea what obstacles lay before her, had no good sense for how deep to dive or which direction to swim. Glasses and phone still in hand, she pawed at the water to get herself deep. She managed to swim out of the cabin, but now, looming in her face, was the crossbar of the well-crafts bimini top, aluminum bars holding up a canvas sunshade. She spent precious seconds stopping and then maneuvering around it. She swam outward, away from the boat, with her lungs burning, then saw the glimmering surface up there through all that water. She kicked and pulled up and up through all that water and light until it felt as if her lungs would not hold out. And then, at last, she surfaced. Greedily, she sucked in air. Riley, catching her breath, was already being loaded onto a rescue sled. Someone helped Gonzalez swim to the Coast Guard boat. Once she'd boarded, she clutched Riley in a tight bear hug. She and Kraus exchanged a long, tender look. Neither could find the words to express their relief. "Are you okay?" Kraus said at last. "Yeah," Gonzalez replied. "I'm okay." Selfridge flopped up onto the second rescue sled and lay there, heaving with adrenaline and emotion. "You could have killed that little girl," he thought. You okay? Andrew Baxter asked. Yep. Yep, Selfridge said, sitting up. Relieved, Baxter laughed. Look at your shirt, Bob. He looked down. He'd forgotten all about the T-shirt he'd put on that morning, the one with a Superman logo across the chest. That was A Sinking Feeling by Derek Burnett. And now a second article, shorter. The Calendar Girls. After Molly Baker's husband died suddenly, her friends organized a year's worth of support by Sarah Chassay. The date was March 24, 2018, and though Molly Baker didn't know it yet, her world was about to change forever. On that cloudy Saturday morning, she'd just returned to her home in Sammamish, Washington, after a chilly trail run. Her husband, Marlon Baker, an avid skier, had set out early for a day on the slopes of Crystal Mountain, about 2 hours away. Their 14-year-old son, Samuel, was at a friend's house. Molly, then 52, was catching up on her work as an accountant when her cell phone rang. She didn't recognize the number, so she ignored it. Then came a voicemail from the Crystal Mountain Volunteer Ski Patrol. Marlon had been in a skiing accident. Her heart fluttering, she immediately called back. Her husband had been killed. In that moment, Molly remembers falling to her knees and just screaming. My life was completely turned upside down. Everything that I knew, that I counted on, was just blown apart, she says. They'd been married almost 20 years. He was 59. What do I do? She remembers saying aloud in total shock. What do I do? When Carla Vail, one of Molly's closest friends, heard the awful news about Marlon, she knew right away that she wanted to help. Carla and Molly had met 10 years earlier in the pickup line at their son's preschool. I'd been hearing nonstop about this boy named Samuel, and Molly had been hearing nonstop about this boy named Jake. And we were like, oh my gosh, you're the mother of the child I hear about every day, Carla remembers. We just hit it off. They had a lot in common. They both volunteered in the community and loved cooking and hiking. Their two boys already got along, and their husbands became friendly too. We had a lot of threads in our lives that brought us together and kept us together over the years, Molly says. The first week after Marlon's accident, Carla was at Molly's house every day. She helped plan the funeral, and in an effort to organize the outpouring of support from friends, neighbors, and their close-knit church community, created a sign-up sheet so people could drop off meals. The initial schedule quickly filled, Carla remembers. I was getting emails saying all meal days are taken care of and I want to do something. What can I do? So I had this little card, and I would write each name down and say, can I keep your name, and I'll call you? And eventually I had a list going. The roster of names got Carla thinking about her own experience with loss. In her 30s, she'd care for her dying parents, and she'd walk the same path with her in-laws and an aunt. One thing I learned is that the flurry of activity when someone dies lasts about 2 weeks. That's when your table is full of flowers and your freezer is full of casserole, she says. But then, naturally, everybody has to go back to a real life. She knew Molly already had crucial daily support from her sister, Kathy O'Brien, who had come to stay with her. But what if Carla could harness this initial wave of love from well-wishers into something more lasting and structured, something that would brighten Molly's days through the difficult year ahead? She looked at the dozen names she had already. I thought, what if I found a few more people and created a rolling calendar where every day of the month there would be someone committed to checking on her, Carla says. That way, nobody would be overtaxed because you only had to do it 12 times in a year. She brought the idea to Molly to make sure she was comfortable with it and to make it clear that none of the women wanted Molly to feel pressure to socialize every day. One thing I said was, this isn't anyone knocking at your door, Carly explains. No one's going to show up demanding something. And if someone does show up with flowers on their day, you don't have to answer the door. With Molly's blessing, Carla took the name she had, brainstormed a few more contacts to add, and then crafted an email to 31 women, and the Calendar Girls were born. Carla's pitch to the Calendar Girls was simple. Perform a small gesture for Molly. Think a card, a call, or a coffee, she says, on the same assigned date monthly, or for one whole year. So if someone chose the first of the month, each time that day rolled around, she might walk Molly's dog, offer to run an errand for her, or simply text her a prayer. As the weeks and months went by, Molly's Calendar Girls showed up for her day in and day out. Nicole, who lived three houses away, brought by a delicious hot meal, along with flowers and a card. Tony, who also lived in the neighborhood, would often meet Molly for a walk. Her friend Rachel liked to leave a little something on the baker's porch bench. Chocolates, a handmade gift, a handwritten note. Jana, from church, met her for lunch and was always sending prayers. Each day, a new person would reach out with a kind word, an invitation to have coffee, an offer to pick up a gallon of milk. Lauren one morning, Tiffany the next afternoon, and as each month came to a close, the Calendar Girls geared up to start the rotation over again. That ongoing support made all the difference for Molly. When someone dies, a lot of times people don't know what to do or say, and so they do nothing, she says. So I always tell people, do something. Don't do nothing, do something. Carla agrees. You don't always have to exchange any words when someone's grieving, she says. It's okay just to sit with them or walk a dog. It's just that companionship of knowing you're not alone. We've run out of time for today's episode. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.